morning from the Summit Responsible Solutions Studios. Welcome to Better Lawns and Gardens. I'm your host and garden expert, Teresa Watkins. So glad to be here with you this morning and with Lizzie, our producer. Beautiful weather this week, Lizzie. How was yours?
Oh, it was stupendous. I did a lot of outside work and got caught up on a lot of stuff that I needed to get caught up on, and I wasn't having to drink 50 gallons of water. So
no, it was the cooler weather's here. We have a taste of fall, and so we're seeing it also in the trees, the cypress trees, the sycamores, the sweet gums are all starting to change color, and I love seeing that. And so you made some really great reels this week on Facebook. And so how are Geraldine and Gerald doing?
Geraldine and Gerald are doing fine with Jack and a Cracker, my 6-month-old turkeys that are full-size turkeys now. So
wow. Do they still want to climb in your lap, or is it just the bourbon reds?
Yeah, just the 4-month-old bourbon reds. Yeah, we ended up rehoming 2 of the 5 bourbon reds that we hadn't already rehomed the other 5 prior to that. Uh-huh. And the 2 hens, we kept 2 hens and 1 tom of the bourbon reds, and I have the 1 hen, and she climbs up in my lap if I sit down on the crate inside their coop and run area. She just wants to be a part of me.
Okay, and so I was just asking you, is there a difference between the taste of the white turkeys like Gerald and the bourbon reds?
Okay, so the research that I did is that the bourbon reds supposedly taste a lot yummier. I don't know how to explain it.
And there's no bourbon involved.
No. And that was, I was like, do people just automatically add bourbon to it when they cook it or what? So I'm not sure. We'll see. So
it sounds like it's like a Louisiana thing.
Yeah.
You know, southern bourbon reds.
Yes.
Because it sounds like bourbon in the south, you know. So,
right.
Well, it's going to be interesting. I'm still praying for Gerald.
So, hashtag spare Gerald.
Hashtag. So let her know what, and you're trying to figure out what to name the 2 reds, the 2 bourbon reds.
The 2 hens, yeah, because my son ended up naming the 1 tom bourbon red that we kept Zip Tie, because he was the one that I decided I wanted to keep out of the flock. So I put a zip tie on around his foot whenever he was when he was little, so I would be able to keep him separate.
Yeah.
And so my son just named him Zip Tie. I'm like, are you kidding me? Well, now his name is Zip Tie.
I think 1 bourbon red should be Lucille Ball, but that's just me. All right. So if you're out there and you're still dealing with the storm debris and effects, you're in our thoughts. I'm still seeing flooded areas, like all the wetland areas off the side roads, especially in Leesburg. They have the wetland areas near Lake Harris. Those are still, the water still comes across the road. Swamps and the wetlands are full. And so we have a really good week this week, the next 10 days, North Florida. You're going to be in the mid to low 80s, 60s at night. Great sunny weather, no rain. So we usually fertilize our lawns in the starting of October 1st through mid-October. This is a great time now. Your plants are all saturated. They've had the water. The turf's had the water. This is a great time to go and fertilize your lawns for the winter time. And we recommend doing it twice a year, once in the springtime, once in the fall. But with the hurricanes, we just recommended you didn't do it because it would just wash away and get diluted, and you just waste your money and time. Now you've got a good 7 days to go ahead and fertilize, and the rains are not going to be so heavy next weekend, and it'll be a good time to do it. Central Florida, you're going to be in the low 80s too, and a high the 60s at night. No rain expected for 10 days. So once a week watering is just fine. We're going to be doing the time change next month. And if you just want to jump ahead and start doing it now, just water once a week as you need to. My best rain gauge is stick your finger in the ground down to your second knuckle. If the ground is cool, moist, or damp, you do not need to water. Okay, so that's good. South Florida, high 70s and 80, 81 over the next 10 days. Rain's expected on Tuesday and next weekend, but there's a little bit, you know, you'll probably just have some beautiful weather, and we still need the rain. I mean, if we could just get a little bit, half inch of rain once a week, that would be great.
Oh, I know. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this. I turned my sprinklers on at least once this week.
Yeah, you can.
It was bad. Like no, my grass just was like, please.
No, you can turn it on. That's fine. And so we're going to be celebrating a little bit of Halloween this week. It's coming up. And Tony, my husband's birthday is on Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
And it explains so much.
It does. Happy birthday, Tony.
So we're going to be doing that, celebrating that. And we've got a lot of fun coming up with that. And, you know, trick-or-treating is going to be great weather for that. In the garden, if you had anything die during the hurricanes and it's out by the street, you can take those dead branches and stuff and use them to make a great Halloween front yard landscape.
Yeah,
you can decorate with them. So be proud of those dead shrubs and put them out. But I do want to say, do not put out webbing. You know, we have that artificial webbing, spider's web.
Yes.
Don't put it on your hedges. Don't put it on your trees. That really gets the insects get into it, and the hummingbirds and birds get into it as well. This week was the University of Florida's Master Gardener Conference. It was a great conference with Carol Reese and Jenks Farmer as their main speakers. Carol Reese and Jenks Farmer, they joined us in the studio, Lizzie. We had a great time with them.
Yes.
And so we got to have a personal conversation with them. They're coming up next. Is the outstanding garden expert from the University of Tennessee Extension. She's a down-to-earth true country woman who has a bucolic appreciation for life and words of garden wisdom coming up this Saturday morning. You're listening to Better Lawns and Gardens. I'm Teresa Watkins, and this is Florida's Talk and Entertainment Network. Welcome back to Better Lawns and Gardens. I'm your host, Teresa Watkins, and I have the honor today to have a special guest in the studio, and her name is Carol Reese. She's an retired extension horticultural specialist based at the University of Tennessee's West Tennessee Ag Research and Education Center. You know, we love extension, and she is a nationally known speaker. She blends equal parts of her garden knowledge, natural lore, and quirky humor, and she is funny. Carol's a garden and nature columnist for several newspapers, as well as a contributor to several garden magazines, including the fabulous Horticultural Magazine. Welcome, Carol. It's so nice to have you.
Teresa, good to speak to you again. I appreciate you having me on a few years ago. Glad to be back.
Oh, it's wonderful. You know, I played you your interview as a best of on Better Lawns and Gardens on several occasions. So I just think you are the tops. And so
look out, give me the big head and I'll be terrible.
We'll need to change the headsets. It's Southern Gardens with inspiration from free thinkers like you and our favorite friend, Dr. Gary Bachman, and Jenks Farmer, who's going to be on next week. And the fabulous Tony Avent. You're becoming more mainstream, and you realize that you're an independent thinker. So that started when?
Well, and am I mainstream, or you mean I'm getting more publicity?
That may be it.
I do tend to stir the pot. I think that really probably started way back. I had an older sister, 4 years older, who loved to play teacher when she got home from school. So by the time I got to the first grade, I was fourth grade. I was already reading books beyond my time. I already maybe even understood things like social injustice or when the teachers were wrong. And so I would correct them. I might rewrite the test questions to be more clear and then answer them. Or if you meant this, I'll write it that way and then answer that because I like to be right.
I know the feeling.
So they would send me, actually, they didn't have to teach me reading, writing, and arithmetic, so they would send me to the library where I devoured the books or to the principal's office to do special projects. And I said, I never had to do what everybody else was doing, and I've gotten away with it all my life.
That's great. That's great. And so from all that experience of just being ahead of your time, mm-hmm. and being more mature and experiencing things differently than most people do you have any garden failures or stories where it didn't work out the way you thought it would?
Absolutely. And I think our lesson, the biggest lesson, was probably when I grew up on a dairy farm in Mississippi, Oktibbeha County. Starkville might be the town people know where Mississippi State is located. And we decided to take the old dairy farm once the dairy went defunct and turn it into an orchard. I couldn't stand looking at the idle land. My mother actually was the farmer in the family. So we killed a lot of plants. Golly, did we kill a lot of plants. And one of the first big lessons was regional adaptation. We joined a group called NAFEX, North American Fruit Explorers. I'm sure you're familiar
yes.
with. You have a vast array of experience, by the way. Very impressive. And so we would travel to different fruit-growing regions around the country, and they'd say, well, they're able to grow this apple or this peach with, you know, low or minimum inputs. And we'd take them back to Mississippi where they just melted. The onslaught of the jungle of the Deep South, right? The humidity, the weeds,
the moisture, the rainfall.
Insects that mm-hmm. love it here. So we learned very quickly that we needed a separate group. So my father was actually one of the founders of Southern Fruit Fellowship.
Oh.
Which did basically the same thing, but it was devoted to plants of the Southeast. And that's how we came to be now our major crop on our farm in Mississippi is Asian persimmon, because right here in Florida, my parents took a picture where they got their first bite, and that was when they fell in love with them, and we began to grow them.
I love that. Yeah. I had a question about Asian persimmons a couple of weeks ago, so that's fascinating. I love that. And so working with Extension and you're working with farmers, a lot of them, way back, they weren't used to seeing women working like your mother
right.
on the farm. That was unusual.
Right.
And so how did you get them to take you seriously?
Well, you have to convince them that you are actually a farmer.
Mm.
If they don't want to hear what you're trying to tell them, then if you'll start out the lead by, first of all, talk the talk. You got to go to the co-op and learn how to talk farmer, right?
Mm-hmm.
But also, once they learn you can actually drive a tractor, you can back up a trailer, that you've put in all the irrigation on the fields, that you know how to calibrate things, finally, you know, they'll give you a little bit of grudging respect. When they would tell me, you people got all your learning from books, don't know diddly, I'll use a nice word there, I agreed with them. I said, absolutely, academia is not where it's at. It's simply another layer of information. But it actually is where the boot meets the ground. It's where you really learn the real gardening and what happens and what fails. One of the things they told us about was actually how to change the soil pH, because the first orchard we tried being blueberries.
Mm-hmm.
We did all the peat moss and sulfur and all that kind of stuff that you were supposed to put in the holes. And it maybe made a teeny bit of difference, but the original pH crept back in.
Mm-hmm. It's going to revert back.
Yeah, it's going to revert back over time. Mm-hmm. So we learned very quickly, choose the right plant. That's how we ended up with the Asian persimmons. On the right, you could lay a soil map down over that field and show where the still blueberries planted in the 1980s, rabbit eyes are still thriving.
Wow.
And then other parts of the field where they never thrived and where the Asian persimmons do now. And the other thing was, mess up that root ball. Everybody said, don't, just back in those days, which is another interesting lesson, right? We've had to unlearn a lot of the things we were
did.
Taught.
What we were teaching back 10, 15 years ago,
yeah.
We're no longer teaching.
Right. So bust up that root ball, choose the right plants for the soil. And then, of course, there were just so many other lessons involved in there about hardiness. And learning to spring plant some things, even though fall is often touted as the best time to plant.
So you mentioned that, and it just brought it to mind. What do you think of the USDA changing the zones?
Well, it's funny because zones are really kind of a suggestion. They're the best we can do in our poor little finite human brain to say these should survive. But things are so unpredictable now. Yes, we're warmer. I mean, we don't have to look at so many records before mm-hmm. we're convinced. And we could debate all day the whys, but the truth is we are warmer, and our zones are creeping north. But then we have these extreme circumstances of cold snaps,
mm-hmm.
things that in my 73 years now.
Congratulations and happy birthday.
Thank you. That we have seen, like the Christmas vortex of, mm-hmm. that was 2022, wasn't
yes.
it? When we went from, in my part of West Tennessee, upper 40s to zero in a matter of like 11 hours, and things weren't properly hardened off. Or the Easter freeze of 2007, where we had the warmest March on record, followed by a real extreme cold event in April that killed back the foliage of pecans, hickories,
amazing
oak trees, and plants that were rated hardy to zone 5. So do I think it should be rated that way? I think it's, again, it's a suggestion, but I think more and more we're going to have to look for plants that withstand extremes.
you know, between two zones or three zones,
yes,
the middle.
Right.
You know, pick the median.
You may know of my friend Felder Rushing.
I do. I love
Mississippian.
Felder.
He said, I'm traveling out to the places that have the most extreme weather, Texas Panhandle, Oklahoma, have hot, droughty summers and cold, drying wind winters. And what works there may be what we have to rely on now.
I think so. I tell people that, yes, we can kind of use it, mm-hmm. but we're still going to see freezes. Yep. We're getting warmer, but we're going to see that 80 degrees one day
yep.
and 30 degrees the next day.
Yep.
That cold front's going to come down through. So I appreciate what you're saying on that. I do want to know, too, how do you feel about GMOs?
Well, I think it's a great tool.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great tool, and I usually get my foot in the door because a lot of people just think GMOs are bad, period. And I remember watching Jimmy Kimmel, some guy he had on there interviewing people on the street about what is a GMO, and most couldn't tell you except that they're bad. But then if you research it, most people who are diabetic use insulin made with GMO. And then my little gambit to get my toe in the door is, if you know the story of the American chestnut, once the greatest providers for wildlife we ever had in the eastern forest, and of course it succumbed to a blight.
Right.
Well, they've done a lot of crossbreeding with Chinese chestnut, but what if we could just take that disease resistance from Chinese chestnut, insert it into the American chestnut, and all we've done is alter one gene. It's right. still an American chestnut.
We have a great chestnut here in Florida called the Dunstan's chestnut.
Yeah, I know
and it's, of them. And it's popular, just grown all over the country now. So that is incredible. Well, good. It's common sense, isn't it?
It's common sense. If we could make a plant be more drought tolerant, there's actually a woman scientist where I work, and she is inserting drought tolerant genes into our crops,
mm-hmm.
so that other countries, arid countries, can actually grow their own crops. We can't continue to feed the world. We need to get them more able to grow their own. So can GMOs be good? Absolutely. Can we make things, I think it's all about how things are used. Sometimes if we look at things turning green in the night, but that shouldn't be the whole message. We should look at the whole picture.
Very smart, very smart. Okay, so that sounded like a garden rant. And so you are one of the members, founding members of the garden rant?
I'm not a founding member.
Okay.
And I was a member for a while. I kind of, when I retired, I got to dislike deadlines. You know, it was good for me. I'm very undisciplined. And when I wrote the newspaper column, having to put a concise story together in X amount of words was a very good writing tool to learn. Edit, whittle, get it in on time. And in some ways, I miss the discipline. But at the same time, I'm trying to write a couple of books.
Wonderful. So that's where can people find more about Carol Reese?
Well, I do Facebook, and I do have some social media presence. I don't have my own website yet, and I don't do any of that because as of right now, as a retired person who has a place out in the country in the middle of nowhere, I treasure my solitude.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have to stay in touch with the public as much as I do. I'm at the stage of my career where I'm okay. I've got enough money to make it. I like making some extra money because I take in rescue dogs. I think you know that.
I do know
they're
that.
They're a very expensive hobby. That and buying plants.
You have 19 dogs, right?
I have 19 currently, and I've adopted out probably 200 or 300
oh,
dogs.
Oh, my goodness.
And before somebody gets mad, yes, they are all fixed. I get them all vetted immediately, and then I send them mostly to white-collar homes up north.
We're coming on a hard break, but Carol, you spoke to the Florida Master Gardeners mm-hmm. at the University of Florida this week. What did you tell them, real quick?
I wanted them to hear the benefits of some of the non-native plants that continually get bashed.
There you go. Thank you so much for coming on today, Carol. It's great to have you in the studio live. I do appreciate it. You're just marvelous.
Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Better Lawns and Gardens. I'm Teresa Watkins. I want to give a big thank you to Carol Reese for her great interview. She is a wonderful and funny gardener.
Oh, she's a hoot.
She is, really. And we have more of Carol's interview coming up in the next few weeks. And we have Jenks Farmer coming up next week. So lots of great interviews from people who really work the farms and know what they're talking about. So I love gathering all the information from them. It's now time for your gardening questions and texts. I'd love to talk with you. You can give Lizzie a call at 888-455-2967, or you can text me at 23680. Also, too, I want to give a big hello to our new subscribers to our Facebook page, Isaac and Megan. And thank you to Doug and Frank, Linda and Laura for being such great fans. And they always, post on our page and like our posts. So we do appreciate that. I'd also like to give a big shout out to Chris and Tom, who I met with yesterday. And they said they love listening to the show. And Lizzie, they love you.
And, I love our listeners too. They're the best.
Exactly. 1-888-455-2967, or you can text me at 23680. Linda, Zone 8B, she said, in the springtime, her front acreage is almost a yellow sea of beautiful wildflowers. She's going to do the back acreage with the wildflower beds that I've talked about on the show. She said the problem is next spring. She needs to have the acreage commercially treated for sand spurs, and how will this emergent affect the wildflowers? It's going to affect them a lot, Linda. It's not going to let these wildflower seeds germinate. And so, as you know, the wildflowers are dormant over the wintertime, and then in the springtime, they start to germinate and emerge. So, got a couple of ways to do this. If you have an area that you know where you have the sand spurs, I would treat that area and then go ahead and put the wildflower seeds around it or in other areas. Other than that, you can just get rid of the sand spurs this year, and you should not have an issue with them in the coming years if you've treated it really, really well. And then next year, 2026, or at the end of 2025, go ahead and put the seeds down so that they will germinate in the spring of 2026. I would not do them if you have to spray the entire back acreage with treat it for sand spurs, okay? Because it's going to stop the wildflower seeds from germinating. Great question. I love that. And I love that you're putting down wildflowers. Send us pictures. We would love to see pictures.
Okay. How do you treat for sand spurs? Because I'm going to tell you, I don't know what happened this year. We have not had sand spurs in probably at least a solid almost 30 years. Like, my grandmother and my dad went around daily whenever my dad retired and would pull the root,
throw it away, and
literally like put it right. I mean, it was all compartmentalized, or whatever you'd call it. I mean, contained. There you mm-hmm. go. And yeah, no boo-boos, no nothing for a couple of years. And we haven't had sand spurs since then. Then all of a sudden this year, I'm looking around going, oh my God, what happened?
Yeah, the seeds. So something came through, like a wild animal, a bird. The possums and the raccoons and the mm-hmm. coyotes, they'll bring the seeds in. And once the seeds get in, that's how they germinate. So those actual sand spurs, the prickles, they are the seed. And if you don't get them out of the yard, then the next season they pop up.
I'm going to be checking people coming on my property like they have got ticks or something.
And you could get it from cars coming in too, on your tires and things. So I would put, you need to do a pre-emergent to stop it from even germinating.
Okay.
Okay, so that's what she means by treating for the sand spurs.
Gotcha.
She's putting a pre-emergent down that is probably a chemical or a commercial product.
Okay.
Okay, but you can put down an herbicide that is a pre-emergent, will stop the seeds from germinating.
Yeah, because we ended up getting some sod, and we kind of went the cheap way, which we should never be in former landscape people. We should not do that. Yeah. Never go the cheap way. And we ended up with the little stinging needles.
Yes.
They started popping up all over. Yeah. So I literally spent a month, and I would go squirt, 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 and I would do it all the way to the root. Like, I'd almost use a whole bottle on just one, and we had like 300, you know? So,
yeah.
But yeah, and boom. It's done good.
It's done.
Yep.
The herbicides are important tool in keeping acreage and pastures and even homeowners' yards from getting a weed issue. So okay. You just got to keep on top of it. Putting a pre-emergent down in the wintertime, January, February. So it takes 5 days of warm temperatures mm-hmm. for weeds to germinate.
Oh.
So if we have a couple of weeks where we're in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and then all of a sudden it jumps up to 80 degrees, and we have a week of 80 degrees, which we do in January.
That's Florida.
It's Florida. That's when the weeds start to germinate and get into a problem. So you just want to keep an eye on it. And if you know you have a problem in a certain area, treat it as soon as you have those 5 days of warm and prevent them from even germinating.
Uh-huh.
And then if you do have a weed issue spring and summer, bag your clippings. Don't put those grass blades or those weed seeds back into the ground.
Right.
Bag your clippings of your lawnmower, and that'll be half the battle right there, not putting them back into the ground.
Okay. Well, that's good information. Thank
you. There you go. 1-888-455-2967, or you can text 23680 if you have a gardening question. We'd love to hear from it. Good morning, Ira. Glad you're back in your house again and having coffee with us this morning. So that, I appreciate that. So speaking of Halloween, it's coming up this week. I have some trees and plants that are really, really, really very unusual, scary for Halloween. And one is the bloodwood tree. Now, the bloodwood tree is a type of teak that grows in southern Africa and particularly near the Namibia-Angola border. It has a gray-brown bark that resembles that of just another hardwood tree, but what flows from it is chilling. The bloodwood tree is called that because it bleeds bright red sap when it's cut or wounded. And like real blood, the sap the trees ooze actually seals their cuts and heals them. So that's kind of, it does look like blood coming from the tree.
I want everybody to stop what you're doing right now and take your phone or your computer, and I want you to search bloodwood tree and look at the photos, because I'm like, oh my gosh, it's bleeding.
And so our trees, when you cut it, you can get a wound. It used to be the practice, just like Carol and I were talking about, that you used to paint these wounds and seal them. No longer recommended. Just like we wear a Band-Aid where the air can get through, you don't actually seal your skin. You just put the Band-Aid over it to keep dirt from getting into it, but it has air can get through, and you know there's a space in there. The same with trees. You want to leave it open and let Mother Nature do her thing. There's no reason to paint trees anymore. So that's just a new thinking that we've discovered through research, that a sealing, painting a wound, putting in, if you have holes in your trees, putting it in with styrofoam or filling it in with cement, don't do that. That's not a good thing. That's scary. And so we have another really eerie grape for Alfred Hitchcock or Sven Gulli, the white baneberry doll's eyes. And these creepy berries are aptly named. They look like eyeballs on flesh red stems, and the berries will watch you as you walk through hardwood forest in the USA or Canada. It grows all over the country. And as it wasn't already unsettling enough, these plants are highly toxic to human beings. So if you see eyeballs growing in the forest, don't go popping them in your mouth. And so, because they are toxic, they can cause cardiac arrest or death upon their ingestion. So no eating the eyeballs. And then one of the other ones that I love, and I've seen it recently down at the Bromeliad Society at Jim Jackson's house. He has them. We have them at our house. And Rollins College, I've gone to see when they're Amorphophallus titanium, also called the corpse flower. And it's called the corpse flower because it smells just like rotting bodies.
Ugh.
And it is the largest flower on earth. And so, but it emits the odor of rotting flesh. It can reach heights of almost 15 to 20 feet tall. And it's an evolutionary technique that it gets pollinated by insects that love carrion and meat and, you know, animals that have been killed. And it attracts flies and dung beetles. So how's that for Halloween? There you go.
Mm-hmm.
All right. It's Saturday morning. You're listening to Better Lawns and Gardens. I'm Teresa Watkins, and this is Florida's Talk and Entertainment Network.
Welcome back to Better Lawns and Gardens. And now, Teresa's top five.
For Halloween, these are my top five scary landscaping practices that I see out in the world driving around and talking with my clients and at my workshops with the questions. One, crepe murder. Okay, we're going to come up on the wintertime and people are going to be chopping their crepe myrtles back. No need to do that unless it's in the wrong place. You want to make sure you plant the right plant. The next one is spraying pesticides without having any pests. You should only spray pesticides when you can identify that there is pest issues. The next one is scalping turf grass. People think, oh, I don't have to mow as often, so I'm going to cut it really low. Worst thing you can do with grass, turf grass, the height of your blade grass is the depth of your root system. If you're scalping, you're not going to have it do very well. And then the next one is keeping monstrous invasives in your yard. Australian pine trees, Brazilian pepper, tropical soda apple. If you see these, they should be removed. And the last one is hurricane pruning, cutting off palm trees just so that the fronds don't fall off and it makes them more susceptible to winds. Don't do that. It's too scary. So that's my top five. Thank you, Lizzie, very much.
You're
welcome. 1-888-455-2967 if you're in the garden area and have a gardening question. And you could also text me 23680. So Nancy in Merritt Island says, my plumeria leaves are getting brown spots and turning brown and falling off. This has affected three of them. Other than cutting them off, is there anything else I can do? Said, thank you so much for being so helpful. Well, thank you, Nancy, for listening. We do appreciate you being part of our world out here. So we love that. Okay, so plumeria gets rust, and that's the little brown spots. It's a fungus disease issue, and it comes from either the rain, and it comes at the end of their growing season. And so the rust on there does affect, and it does spread. So things that you can do to prevent it. One, make sure that you're watering at the right time of day. You should be watering at 5 o'clock in the morning or later. If plants stay wet longer than 5 hours, this is Florida with our humidity and our rainfall and irrigation and the disease and pathogen problems we have here. The longer your plants stay wet, the more susceptible they are to disease. So start your watering at 5 to 6 o'clock in the morning, and you can water all the way through 10, and that's usually enough time to get your landscape watered. All right? The other thing is that if you know that you're going to get it, then you can spray a fungicide in June, July, and then again in August, and that will prevent the disease. You can't cure a fungus issue. You can't cure a rust issue. You have to prevent it. So spray in a fungicide before the plant gets the disease issue and the fungal issue, then that will prevent it. The other thing is your plumeria leaves are going to fall off when it goes dormant in the wintertime. When it gets that first cold snap, the leaves are going to fall anyway. So I wouldn't do anything to it, but make sure you pick up the diseased leaves. Don't leave them lying on the ground because that just puts it into the ground, those rust spores into the ground, and next year you're going to get the rust issue again. So be very clean when you have fungal issues to pick up the diseased leaves and throw them away. So great question, Nancy. I hope you do really well. Let's go to Bill in Ormond Beach. Good morning, Bill. How are you?
Good morning, Teresa. Hey, I've got this dragon blood tree that I've had for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And after Milton went by and dumped a foot of rain in 12 hours on us, I was out in the yard yesterday and saw a discoloration at the top of the plant. The rest of the plant looks great, mm-hmm. but then I could smell it, too.
Uh-huh.
And I could pull some of those leaves out of the center.
Mm-hmm.
So I had heard that there is something for palm trees that people use after a freeze to keep the bud, the center of the plant from dying.
Mm-hmm.
Is there some kind of concoction that you know of?
Yes, you can use hydrogen peroxide and spray that apical tip that's right there, the leaves coming out, spray that area, or use a copper fungicide, Bill.
And, okay. Would I use the hydrogen peroxide full strength?
Yes. Yes, okay. It won't hurt it. But now the other issue is, you know that you can cut that at any location. If it dies, you know, that area dies, you can cut below that, and it will sprout back out again at that area. So dracaenas are really easy to cut, and they spring, they produce leaves wherever you cut.
Okay.
Okay?
Well, that's comforting. Thank you.
All right.
Appreciate that.
You're welcome. You're welcome. How's the Bromeliad Society doing there?
Oh, we're still kicking. We didn't have last month's meeting because the park we normally have it in got flooded. So we had to skip last month, but we have someone from Lou Garden coming over this next month.
Okay, well, tell everybody where they can come to your meetings. If you love bromeliads, join a bromeliad society. They're very generous, and you get to look and grow beautiful bromeliads. Tell them where the next meeting is and when.
Well, the next meeting is, it's always the second Sunday at 1:30 at a park. It's a trailer park called Colony in the Woods. At 4000 Clyde Morris Boulevard in Port Orange. And and it's a fun-loving group. We're not, we don't go hard and heavy at it. It's a bunch of homeowners that really enjoy the plant. And we do trips and tips and tricks. And Teresa has blessed us with coming by twice, and I'm sure she'll be by again.
Yes, I'd love to talk to your group.
And it's just a fun time.
It is. It's a good group, and it's, like I said, you're real generous. So you help new learners or new bromeliad growers learn about the plants, and you just are a great group to have. So join. And what's the name of the Bromeliad Society? East Coast?
It's Florida East Coast Bromeliad Society, but the people in Orlando, there's the Orlando group, and there's the Seminole group also.
Great. Thank you so much, Bill. I let me know how your dracaena does.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. And so I will post information on the Bromeliad Society when we post upload the podcast, and you'll find that on our Facebook page. And so I'd like to thank Carol Reese, retired University of Tennessee Extension, the Ag Research Center there in Tennessee. She's back home now. She came down to talk to the University of Florida Master Gardeners during their conference, and she is just a wonderful, just a full of knowledge.
I could just sit there and just listen to her talk. I absolutely love her sound and her knowledge. I'm just like, okay, all right, next.
Exactly. And so we're going to be back with your phone calls, 1-888-455-2967. Put that in your phone. And you can call or text anytime. We are coming up. The next hour is going to be your gardening questions. Great time to get answers, especially after the storm. What's going on in your landscape? What should you be doing? If it's Saturday morning, you're listening to Better Lawns and Gardens. I'm Teresa Watkins, and this is Florida's Talk and Entertainment Network.
If you missed that interview with Carol Reese, go to betterlawns.com. We'll be posting it today. That's betterlawns.com.